Good afternoon and welcome to today's Deloitte Fireside Chat, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I am Dr. James McKinney, Clinical Professor in Accounting and Information Assurance at the Robert H. Smith School of Business, University of Maryland, and moderator for today's program. The Deloitte Fireside Chat series is made possible through a partnership between Deloitte LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Deloitte is a brand name under which tens of thousands of dedicated professionals and independent firms throughout the world collaborate to provide audit, consulting, financial advisory, risk management, and tax services to selected clients. The SEC Historical Society, through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. The virtual museum and archive is the preeminent online source for original and primary material on the regulation of the capital markets. Today's broadcast is the 11th in a series that began in 2009 to address current issues in financial regulation of interest to the accounting and auditing professions. All past broadcasts, ranging from financial reporting to the role of professional judgment, are available in the Deloitte Fireside Chat section under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive. I had the privilege of moderating a chat in 2012 on international convergence. I'm happy to share that more than 32,000 visitors to the Virtual Museum and Archive have accessed one or more of these chats during or since broadcast. I encourage those joining with us today to check out the Deloitte Fireside Chat section at the conclusion of the broadcast. The series will be well worth your time. Today's program will be looking at disclosure effectiveness. I am joined today by James Croker, Daniel Murdoch, and Thomas Omberg. Jim Croker was appointed a member and vice chairman of the Financial Accounting Standards Board on September 1, 2013. He previously served with Deloitte LLP as deputy managing partner for professional practice. Jim also served as SEC chief accountant from 2009 to 2012. Dan Murdoch serves as vice president, corporate controller for Comcast Corporation. Prior to joining Comcast earlier this year, Dan served as deputy SEC chief accountant. He previously was Deloitte & Touche LLP's audit industry professional practice director for media and entertainment. Tom Omberg is Deloitte's national managing partner, quality and professional practice network. During the early 2000s, he was deputy controller for Bear Stearns & Company. Gentlemen, welcome. So let's go ahead and begin with this discussion. And since we're starting this discussion, why don't we discuss why are we talking about the subject to begin with? Why are we discussing disclosure effectiveness today?
So I'm happy to lead off. This is Jim. I think we're talking about it for a number of reasons. One, disclosure effectiveness potentially means different things to different people. And while I think there's some shared goals when people talk about disclosure effectiveness at the highest level, that is, investors want the information that they need in order to make informed capital allocation decisions. And I think there's a mutual interest between investors and preparers. They want reduced cost of capital. And so I think at that level, the system works well and has shared goals. When you get below that, I think there are differing perspectives about the amount of information that can be consumed by different types and different classes of investors. A different perspective on costs and benefits, at least at some level, and differing perspectives of whether or not we have too much information provided today, and is all of that information material, or in some cases, do we have too little information? So hopefully we'll be able to explore that throughout the course of this discussion.
from a more practical standpoint, the Jobs Act was passed a little while back, and it required the SEC to do a study of the sort of the costs of compliance with regard to registrants and disclosure. And I think it's important to note that this is not a new subject for us as a profession. I think it's one that we take off the shelf and talk about every once in a while. Certainly something that the FASB has talked about in the past. As I think about it, I think the last time that it was discussed in earnest, it ended up with more disclosure that was required around pension accounting. And so, it's very timely today because if you look at, sort of the size of people's documents from years ago to where they are today, they just keep getting bigger and bigger. So when you think about the cost of compliance, that's it's a good time to be having that discussion today.
Yeah, so I think as Dan mentioned, this isn't a new topic. We've been talking about it off and on for 20 plus years. I think if you go back to the 90s, there was the summary annual report that was supposed to help somewhat with disclosure effectiveness, and unfortunately it didn't. But as Dan mentioned, I mean, I think we've seen 10-Ks, 10-Qs, and other financial reports that have just gotten longer and longer. And during that time, we've also seen the reporting deadlines get shorter and shorter. And so, I think the importance of talking about disclosure effectiveness is that as you shorten reporting deadlines and as you lengthen the disclosure requirements in the financial statements, it just creates more risk around how can you get a quality financial statement out in the time allotted. So I think it's really important that we have this conversation now, not so much about whether we can reduce the number of disclosures, but how do we make sure that the right things are being disclosed? And I know we'll talk about that today, and then hopefully at the end of this, we'll say, is something going to be different this time around than has come out of all the dialogues that we've had over the last 20 or so years?
I think even in the title, it's important to note that it's disclosure effectiveness. And Tom, you just went through that. If you went back a couple years, it started as disclosure overload, and that sort of terminology fell away relatively quickly, because I think that while the impetus of the conversation this time around has been cost of compliance and too much disclosure, not just from an inefficiency standpoint, from an ineffectiveness standpoint, if there's too much information, it could sort of you could get lost in the trees, so to speak. But part of this discussion, this conversation that the profession is having, could very well lead to more disclosure. So if you think about just something that the FASB's done recently with respect to revenue, that's an area that, if you look historically, was lacking in disclosures because there weren't many requirements. And so now there'll be a lot of disclosures coming around an area that you'd expect a lot of good, robust disclosure, considering how important revenue is. So even in the title, I think it's telling in terms of what we're trying to accomplish today.
So why don't we talk about who actually uses this information, who are the users of the disclosure that's being put out, and what is the optimal balance of information for each of those?
So from the standard setter perspective, we need to think about users relatively broadly. That is, anyone using I'll start with what's directly in our remit. That is, anyone using financial statements to make capital allocation decisions. And that's a pretty broad group of people when you think about it. That could be range all the way from the individual equity investor who might have might be savvy and sophisticated, but differing level of sophistication or ability to process information, say, than a hedge fund manager or an institutional investor. So you have equity capital at one side, debt investors, all the way to suppliers or even employees who might be making effectively capital allocation decisions by going to work at a company, taking stock or taking a pension plan that might not be paid for years. So you have a broad group of users just at that level, which is, I think, part of what makes this discussion so challenging.
Yeah, and I think it's you can talk about it at two levels, if you would. There's a way to talk about it at a very high level, and I think about it with respect to the FASB, that they have to serve all users. And if you think about the institutional investors and the rise in the amount of money that's managed by institutional investors vis-a-vis the retail investors, so over the last several decades, you're seeing less and less direct holdings by the sort of the individual or the retail investor, and more sort of passive investing or institutional investors. And so when you think about it from a preparer standpoint and how we prepare the document, we're probably not so linear as to say we are preparing this document for an institutional investor or for a retail investor. But when you in terms of how we talk about it and think about it, it's more, I'll say, maybe the Supreme Court definition, reasonable investor. And what I mean by that is that there'll be many of us involved in producing the document, whether it's the 10-K, the 10-Q, or other information that we post on our website. And we sort of ask ourselves the question, does this make sense? Does this make sense to us? And so intuitively to me, that arrives at us essentially building the disclosure for a reasonable retail investor, an individual investor. And if it doesn't pass that test, that's what causes us to sort of go back and think, is that something that we really need, or do we need more? So I think from our standpoint, in terms of how we prepare our documents or our disclosure, it is focused around that individual investor. Now, I can also say that I think had we coming in from the outside, I think that is the right approach. Because if you think about an institutional investor and sort of the rise of technology over the last several decades, there's no such thing as too much information. You can go from 50 pages to 500 pages, and if you have the software, you can just check the changes from one document to another. So there's never really, you know, too much information for an institutional investor. Now, a retail investor, or, you know, somebody that we might know that tries to pick up the document and gets through 500 pages, that's you know, really pretty difficult. And there's even a conflict of interest, one might say, between those two, right? Because the institutional investor wants to manage the money of the individual investor. So, you know, I think whether from organically that's how it developed or from an outsider coming into the organization and being there in a relatively short period of time, that to me is the right perspective, is to sort of build it for the individual investor. But I think that's fundamental in terms of how you approach the issue and how you hear about users' perspectives with respect to can there be too much information, because you have to sort of decide which investor is speaking. Is it the individual or the institutional?
Yeah, and I mean, I think Dan really hit on something, that if you look at the scale and the depth of users and you look at how that's grown over the last 10, 20 years, it's really grown significantly. So then when you think about the disclosures that those investors are looking for and that those users of the financial statements are looking for, because they may not just be investors, they may be regulators, they may be rating agencies, they may be other parties. And so if you think about the depth of what they're looking for and the scope of really what they're looking for, it's really quite significant. And I think if anyone goes and just clicks to an investor relations page on a big public company's website and you see just the dearth of information that's there, the 300-page 10-Ks there, the 150-page 10-Qs there, but you've got earnings releases, you've got the decks that go with the earnings releases, you've got presentations that have been made to investor groups. So, I mean, there is really just a significant amount of information, because the users of financial statements and of information, they've just got an insatiable appetite. And I think that gets us back to this challenge that we have of how do we look at financial statements and how do we look at regulatory filings and make sure that we've got the right information there without getting to the point that we've got overload. And it really comes down to trying to understand what the users want and how can you provide that information in a way that they can actually use it to make the decisions that they want to make or to draw the conclusions that they want to draw.
The other point that Dan made, and I think certainly from the perspective of a standard setter too, we're thinking about the reasonable investor. And so the point is not any consumer of information, but sort of the middle, what is the reasonable man or the reasonable person looking for? But I think the point about information consumption has probably changed even the expectation of what a reasonable person can consume. If you compare the ability to consume information today as opposed to, say, 20, 30 years ago. So even the reasonable person can probably consume more information given technology than say they could 20 or 30 years ago.
There's overlap between the two investors too, and that's part of what makes this all the more intriguing, because if, at least in my discussions with institutional investors, they would similarly agree that if there's information that's really not going to change, you know, sort of the outcome or move the needle, they don't really want that information either. It's just that they don't necessarily have to, sort of trudge through a 500-page document to get to it. So you have what I would argue is both groups, if you looked at them on a scale or a spectrum, if you will, you have them both agreeing with respect to what they want, and that's part of what makes this all the more challenging, right? It's a little bit like Supreme Court Justice Stewart that talked about, you know, he knows it when he sees it. We can all agree in terms of what should be there and what doesn't have to be there, but it's just so hard trying to articulate that and then, you know, getting through the details, whether it's cultural shifts or, you know, how things are written, that gets us to the right answer. But, you know, again, that's what sort of makes it all the more frustrating, is that all these groups, everyone, whether it's standard setters, regulators, users, preparers, we all, they tend to agree as to what should be there, and makes it all the more frustrating in terms of trying to get to that answer.
So why don't we talk about where we should be going? What are some of the goals of disclosure or disclosure effectiveness or effective disclosures for the preparers, issuers, whether the preparers are issuers or non-issuers, for users, standard setters, regulators, and finally, from the viewpoint of the auditors, what are their goals?
So, you know, broadly, I think we would all agree that the goal of disclosures is to provide timely, accurate, clear, and complete information to investors. In just the way that Jim articulated it with respect to making the best capital allocation decisions they can come to. And I would argue that timely and accurate aren't really, if you think about what our goals are today, timely and accurate are not sort of what I would consider as the in the main focus of disclosure effectiveness. And at ARG is probably not even complete, right? Because if anything, we've got, depending on how you approach disclosure, if you approach it with more of a checklist mentality, then you've got completeness and any costs that go associated. But it's really the clearness issue. And so that's a lot of what drives us with respect to how we approach disclosure. And so by way of example, at our company, share-based compensation is not a big number. There's probably two paths you can go down with respect to how we disclose share-based compensation. You can the number is bigger than a bread box, but it's not something that I would argue is that significant the way that other companies might use share-based compensation. So you could provide every single disclosure that's enumerated within the codification. And I think really once you saw the number, you'd realize that those assumptions aren't really going to affect things too much if you're preparing a model or what have you. Or you could go a reduced route. And that's where I'll say, I think it's to the end of clarity. And so with respect to share-based compensation, because it's not a material number to us, we disclose the amount of share-based compensation so that the user can understand how much there is. But then we provide abbreviated disclosures because we don't want to put all of that, all of that information in the document because, frankly, it's just not necessary. And so, I would tell you that from a preparer standpoint, I think the discussion that we're having today is really about that clarity point, both with using, sort of non-jargon language, more plain English where we can, reordering things, trying to put accounting policies next to the footnote that has the numbers, trying to reduce redundancies between the fore part of the document and the back part of the document. But I don't think it's as much, if you looked at our goals today around disclosure effectiveness, as much around timely, accurate, or complete, but more about clarity.
Yeah, and I mean, I think when you look and you say, what are the goals, right? I mean, I think Dan summarized, quite well what everybody wants from disclosure effectiveness, right? How do we get timely? How do we get efficient? How do we get accurate? How do we get the relevant information that the users of financial statements and consumers of financial information want? I do think this topic has become a little controversial, and that people automatically believe that disclosure effectiveness means that all of a sudden preparers are going to start taking things out, and they're going to try to take a 300-page 10-K down to 150 pages. And this really isn't about how do you minimize the financial disclosures that you're making. It's more about trying to figure out with the time that you have to get financial statements out, with the information that the users of financial statements want, how can you drive a better, more efficient set of financial statements that is more useful to investors? I mean, Dan gave a great example around stock comp. I mean, pensions are another one where, the disclosures around pensions are extremely voluminous, and many companies today no longer offer the old style defined benefit, pension plans. And so is it okay for a company who perhaps has a pension plan that's in runoff mode to minimize those disclosures to a certain extent, so that they can focus on what's really important to investors and to users of the financial statements? So it's not about trying to say, let's pare this disclosure down or that disclosure down. It's about trying to figure out, what are the things that investors really want to understand and users of financial statements really want to understand at a deeper level so they can make the decisions that they want to make. And some of that is a little backward looking, and some of that is forward looking. And so it's trying to find the right balance in the disclosures that makes those financial statements more credible and more relevant to the users.
I've heard people describe it as going from compliance to communication. I think that's certainly a good way of describing it. But one of the things, as Tom was talking, that I wouldn't want people to lose on is that interaction with our investor relations department that any public company might have. That if you think about, and I'm totally agreeing with Tom, that one reaction might be it's to reduce cost and take out these things that maybe aren't as significant. But what is significant are things that come into our investor relations department. So as we finished an earnings release and you might get calls about how does this work or how does that work, that's the input we take on a quarter-by-quarter basis and say, okay, investor relations, what kind of information can we provide in the document so that you don't have to answer these kinds of questions? Because you'd rather not be having to answer questions about accounting or what assumption did you use, et cetera. And so that's a dynamic process. And to me, once you can take out the details and focus on the things that are most important, then that makes it a much more effective process where we're all focused on those things that are the most important.
So just a little bit from the what we're doing or what we're focusing on as we think about disclosure effectiveness, just peeling that down a layer, and I think Dan said well, and Tom, I think you made effectively the same point, is the goal is timely and accurate. Those two factors actually compete against each other. I can give you an exceedingly accurate and long document if you gave me a year to produce it, and if you gave me 10 minutes, the accuracy is going to go down and the timeliness increases. And so I think part of that is balance, and we've had a longer list of just absolute requirements and in shorter time frames, as Tom has said. And I think, you know, investors are not going to accept less timely information than we have today. So I think that's off the table. So with those time constraints, or at least from my perspective, so with those time constraints, how do we get to a system that allows you to focus on the important information? Dan described stock compensation or share-based payments. And in our newer standards, we've tended to have, just from an FASB perspective, a longer list of absolute requirements. That standard happens to have an objective that seems fairly simple and goes on to say, in meeting that objective at a minimum, you shall do the following. And I don't think this is a significant overstatement. That goes on for a page plus in terms of the original pronouncement of here are the things that at a minimum you shall do. And that's been the trend, and I think that that's helpful in terms of making sure people comply with the objective. But then when that standard doesn't apply at a particularly significant level, if we're going to do that at an increasing pace at the FASB, providing some flexibility, that is, if those disclosures aren't material to you, you don't need to spend a lot of time providing immaterial information. And we recently proposed an exposure draft that would say just that, if a disclosure is immaterial, you need not provide the disclosure. I'll be very interested in the feedback. But that's really the objective, is how do we focus on the material? We have some standards where there are very few disclosure requirements, and the topic could be exceedingly important. Revenue was one prior to the new revenue recognition standard. Go look at GAAP and try and find the mandated disclosures for revenue. They were pretty short. I suspect of all things that investors are interested in, it's going to be revenue, and companies that tell you they have immaterial revenue have bigger issues than their accounting books and records. They probably have fundamental issues. So how do we have that balance of providing a greater level of detail where it's important, but the flexibility to move forward and not fret the immaterial?
And we, I don't know that we could have a discussion today without bringing in, I'll say this as a former regulator, that, you know, technology is an aspect of this, right? So if you think about what is available electronically today from the SEC, it's essentially a paper format. It's an electronic format of a paper 10K. And so, you know, how much opportunity do we have by enabling technology? And I'm, you know, again, sort of speaking from the way a regulator might look at this, but that's a part of the equation, that if you look, again, to where we were 10 or 20 years ago, or where we'll be in 10 or 20 years, I think there's a lot of value that can be unlocked from there. And if you think about, you know, timely, you know, we're moving to a faster and faster consumption of information. So, you know, that's, I think, you know, certainly part of the discussion. The other part of the discussion is not just the base financial statements, but sort of the fore part of the document, and, you know, the discussion around the business or results. Also, the information that's required of other entities other than the registrant. You know, right now the SEC would have a requirement about which financial statements that you would have for a company that you acquire. And, you know, one perspective on that might say, well, if the FASB has, you know, addressed that in the last 10 or 15 years with respect to business combinations, then do you sort of defer to them and say, well, they've thought about it and they didn't think that private companies needed to have those financial statements, so maybe albeit a standard or a requirement that has been in place a long time, maybe as you look at it today, you don't need it as much because of the disclosures that are required by the standards that are. So it's so big, and, you know, the goals can be so varied even amongst the people here, or if you had a regulator, whether it be of the registrant or the auditing profession. That's part of the challenge in and of itself, right, is trying to define it and then define a clear goal that we can all coalesce around.
Well, and I think, Dan, one of the things when you say it's so big, I mean, we can actually make it a little bit bigger, because I think when we talk about disclosure effectiveness, we really talk about it in the construct of the existing framework that we have, regulatory and standard setting framework that we have. And I do think that users of financial statements, consumers of financial data need to start to think about, well, what information is really important to them? Because a lot of what they see in a 10K is historical. and sometimes dated. And so, you know, do they want to see real-time sales data? Do they want to see, you know, real-time trade statistics for a financial institution or for a broker? And so, you know, it's really thinking about if we're going to have a conversation about disclosure effectiveness, then maybe we should have a broader conversation just around what is the information that the users and consumers of financial data want to see, and is what they're getting relevant? Because, you know, non-GAAP disclosures have become the norm, and in part they've become the norm because the GAAP disclosures aren't good enough for the users of the financial data. So I think we ought to broaden it out and really have a conversation beyond just the existing framework of, you know, what is the relevant information that people want? Because if we get to the end and we solve for disclosure effectiveness, but there's still this insatiable appetite for non-GAAP disclosures and for other information, then we really haven't solved the core issue.
And even this discussion is focused, you could say arguably there's maybe three broad buckets of disclosure, and we're talking about essentially financial disclosure. Another one that is part and parcel, part of the SEC's mandate, is corporate governance type disclosures. And then the third are sort of these public policy type disclosures that maybe don't necessarily fit neatly within the financial disclosures or corporate governance type disclosures, but nevertheless make their way into requirements. And those, a lofty goal, albeit, but it would be helpful as a preparer to understand what even is the document intending to do. Because if you look at it essentially as maybe the 10-K is a financial document, other documents is more corporate governance related, even this the third sort of bucket of items, interesting to sort of get aligned around what the goals are broadly.
And we have a work stream that is looking at least at part of that issue, again, at the FASB mandate being the financial statements. But even there, you get into questions about boundaries and scope. And Dan mentioned, information in the fore part, is it repeated somewhere else in the document? So do you have something, a requirement in MD&A or risk factors, and then you have a similar but not identical requirement in the financial statements? And so the FASB historically has set disclosures at the very end of a project. So you spend years thinking about the debits and the credits and the double entry set of books, and you get to the end of the project, and you say, well, what disclosures should we have? And I think on one hand, that you got to start with the debits and the credits if you're going to do the accounting, but sometimes it's as simple as, well, this would be nice, so let's add this, and does that, is it really needed, or what is the framework? And so we've established a framework to think about the boundaries of what would go in a GAAP set of financial statements. Some of the things you talked about are more forward-looking and absolutely important to investors. From our perspective, we've proposed a disclosure framework that would say forward-looking information really ought to be in MD&A or other spots in a document, not the least of which is because of the legal and regulatory environment in which we operate. That doesn't mean that there wouldn't be things forward-looking in measures of financial statements, a fair value measure, and those disclosures might be in bounds, but really to try and be more structured of how we think about disclosures, so you get consistencies across topic, consistency across time, and then hopefully a greater consistency of the boundaries of financial reporting.
I would argue another goal of the regulator is probably to encourage us, and I'll say us broadly as the preparer community, but to avail ourselves of the tools that are already available to us, right? So you've probably seen or heard people say that many of the four-part disclosure requirements are intended to be complementary. They're not intended to be duplicative, so you don't have to lift literally the same footnote and put it into a different part of the four-part. And I think that's a lot of what the SEC has been trying to get the message out around is, think about those things that you can already do as a preparer group, and it'd be easy to look across the table at an auditor and say, some have speculated, well, is it the preparer that's not pushing it and really trying to get it done? Because you say, look, be careful down that path that you go, because you might get the comment letter that says, hey, where's this disclosure, where's that disclosure, even though, again, we would argue that that's the right thing to do on behalf of investors, and certainly happy to, get into a dialogue about it, but there's some behavioral issues on a preparer side. But behavioral issues on an auditor side that you might say, it might be easy for me as a preparer to say, well, I wanted to do it, but I wasn't sure if my auditor would let me. easy to point to maybe behavioral issues at an audit regulator that would that you know similarly might say, and it's very difficult to sort of piece it apart. And then the attorneys have you know sort of their spot in that discussion as well. That some might say, well, it's the securities attorneys that are encouraging you to put more and more because of the legal remedies that that may afford you. But that I think you know from the SEC standpoint, I think that is a dialogue that they want us to continue to talk about, and that's part of why I offer our perspective on share-based compensation. Our auditors have been, you know, fantastic to work with, and you know, totally understand, you know, the perspectives that we're coming from, and so you know, to that end, we haven't had the same issues. But I will tell you from discussions with other preparers that, you know, it's a very real concern. Why would you want to do this to yourself? Why would you take this on? And that's where, again, our perspective is it's a responsibility. We can't approach this with a checklist mentality because that's doing a disservice to our investors. And we have to do the best to make our document as much of a communication tool as we can. And it's not something that's really elective for us.
Great. Well, now that we've established some goals, and we've already kind of discussed some of this already, but why don't we talk about disclosure challenges? What are some of the challenges that from the different perspectives of the preparers, users, standard setters, auditors, what are some of the success stories that have been achieved by these different parties?
So I mean, I think Dan just hit on some of the challenges, but frankly, what I think are some of the some of the checks and balances that are there, which is the tension that exists, the positive tension that exists, and just a process where you have a preparer and you have an auditor and you have a regulator, and so everybody is looking to make sure that there's the right level of tension, that you know you get the right disclosure in the financial statements. And if you have a preparer who perhaps wants to minimize or who wants to use materiality thresholds, you know, the auditor is there to make sure that you know we put the appropriate independent eye on that. The regulator is there to make sure that you know you've got the right tone in the system around that, and that preparers and auditors have responsibilities. So I think there is that healthy tension that's in the system. But if you look and you say, what are some of the challenges, right? I mean, that healthy tension also creates some of the challenges. Dan talked about, you know, a preparer who perhaps wants to go and take a fresh look at a disclosure and really ask the appropriate questions. Is the disclosure meaningful? Is the disclosure material? Is the disclosure relevant? Right? Well, sometimes that's a conversation that needs to happen between the preparer and the auditor, and there may, in the course of that conversation, the preparer may say, you know what, it's easier for me just to make the disclosure. I don't think it means anything, but it's easier just to make the disclosure. Or, you know, sometimes there's the fear of, is this something I'll get a comment letter on if the SEC reviews my 10-K or my 10-Q, are they going to write a comment letter? And so there's the, I'll over-disclose to potentially avoid having to deal with a comment down the road from a regulator without really taking a step back and thinking if a comment does come in, and it's a well thought out process of, you know, we're not going to make the disclosure because it's not meaningful to users of the financial statements, it's not material, and we have a strong basis for doing it. You know, there is still a little bit of a hesitation in the system, and again, this isn't about reducing relevant, useful disclosure in financial statements. It's all about trying to make the financial statements more relevant, more readable, more understandable, more useful. But there are a lot of different parties that get involved. And look, sometimes it's easier just to take last year's 10-K and roll it forward to this year's 10-K and just update it for whatever happened this year than it is to take, you know, a fresh look and to say, is this really needed? And, you know, I think we've seen some of the success stories because a lot of companies are beginning to look and say, okay, let's take a real good, strong, fresh look. Again, not with the goal of cutting, but asking, why are we disclosing the information we're disclosing? Are we disclosing it because our pensions were relevant 15 years ago and they're not today? So let's go look and let's make sure we understand the regulations and the standards that require the disclosure. Are those still current today? Are they still relevant today? And if not, then, you know, let's make a change. So I think it's people having the ability to step back, look at something through a fresh perspective with the right lens, and then making sure that you've got the right culture in the organization that, again, this is about making the document a better document, and this is about giving something to users of the financial statements that allow them to better understand the company and what's going on at the company.
And I think the discussion today and it has been one, and I think you've described it right, as by and large the healthy tension that exists. I think on occasion you actually get into then a level though of mistrust. So there is a healthy tension, but when something goes wrong, let's say even in the best of circumstances, somebody had to disclose any contingency that was reasonably possible of being material, and somebody with hindsight has got that judgment wrong, that could breed distrust, or maybe it's not so healthy when somebody actually has the assessment but is hesitant to disclose. And I think that's a minority of situations, but when that happens, I think that breeds mistrust between an investor community who wished they had that information when they made their investment decision. And at the other end, I think we're talking to a very reasonable auditor and preparer today. There are a small number of preparers who would say, I just want to scale back the document to scale it back. And so when you get those two ends of the spectrum in the debate, that does make it more challenging. And again, I would describe it as by and large a healthy tension. But that's an aspect or one of the challenges. Another challenge from a standard setter standpoint, and it'll get into what I think is one of the successes, is really how do we get behind the costs and benefits of disclosure. So, it's very easy at one level to understand why something could potentially be useful, but how would an investor actually use that in an analysis, and would it move? Would any individual piece of information that you're thinking about requiring as a disclosure on average move the dial? And we can think about that intellectually, but getting actual investors around the table to say, how would you use this? And then getting preparers to really help us understand what are the costs. If we do something this way, what is the absolute cost of this? And it's very challenging. And one of the success stories I think we've had in doing that was in our revenue recognition standard, where we had articulated a much longer set of disclosures, and investors, by and large, were satisfied. They're not going to say that was too much. But preparers did have some concern about the cost of particular disclosures. We actually got a group of preparers and investors in the same room and around the table, and investors said, I absolutely need this. Companies would articulate the cost and say, what is it you're actually looking for? Because we're not trying to hide anything here, but let us tell you the cost that's involved in doing that. Is there something else that might be done more effectively or efficiently to get you at what you're looking for? So I think actually getting the affected groups around the table, and that includes auditors as well, because what is potentially achievable by a preparer, you then have to think about the audit and the regulatory environment around that as well. Can the audit actually be done at an effective level at the same time?
So I'll come back and maybe amplify a point that I made, but both Jim and Tom talk about healthy tension. I think this is a message, frankly, that we hear from the SEC, but that needs to start with the preparer. So if the preparer starts with let me just roll the document forward, and it's compliant, and it's got the full set, and it's got everything it could possibly have, I would argue that there's one piece of tension missing, because it's our document to prepare. If that's what we think, it's not really not the auditor's place or the regulator's place to say you have too much information. You're not going to get a comment letter from the SEC that says, please take out these disclosures. And so while I would agree with Tom and Jim that in terms of the ideal, that healthy tension is built into the system, that's a good way to design the process. It has to start with the preparer taking up the charge to try and turn that document into something that's more meaningful, arguably. And that without that healthy tension won't exist. So, agreeing with you, we might differ with respect to how much that healthy tension exists around disclosure. I think it would be good for it to exist more with preparers, sort of initiating that conversation about removing some things.
Jim, you talked about bringing in, users and having a conversation around how they're using the information. And I do think as we go down the path of disclosure effectiveness, that forms like that are really going to be crucial. And not just users, but users and preparers. I mean, I frequently hear, from preparers when we talk about perhaps omitted disclosures, I frequently hear from them, yes, I understand that it's required and it may, the numbers themselves may be material, but No one has ever asked me about that information. Now, I don't take the no one has ever asked me about the information in footnote 10 to mean if you took it out, nobody would notice, because maybe it's crystal clear to the people who are reading it, and they rely on it, and they really use it in the analysis that they do. But it's also possible that no one's using that information at all. And again, if you just sort of look at relevance over time, I mean, information that was probably relevant, 10 or 15 years ago may still be relevant today, but it might not be. And so I do think that, as hard as it might be, trying to find the forum to get users and preparers together to really go through and make sure that we're disclosing. I mean, at the end of the day, these are all choices that have to be made. There isn't an infinite amount of resources or an infinite amount of time to put together a set of financial statements or to put together a 10-K. And so we've really got to be mindful about making sure that with the time constraints that are there, and with reasonable resource constraints, how do we make sure that we're getting the right and best information? Recognizing that there are some users of the financial statements that want every piece of data they can possibly put their hands on. And I don't know that we can build a disclosure model that would fully satisfy, that group. But making sure, to Dan's earlier point about, figuring out who the right users of the financial statements are, and really on almost a, continuous basis, looking at those disclosures, again, not to make them shorter, but to make sure that things that are no longer relevant are coming out. And the reality is, when that happens, there are probably things that are relevant that, we need to think about getting in.
And we've touched on the point, but I think it's worth saying again, it is not just a cost play to do this. In fact, what our experience was is that there is a cost the first year that you do it. And I shouldn't say first because it's an ongoing document, but any year that you give it a fresh look, and we did that a few years back. Share-based compensation was one of them, derivatives was one of them, and pension disclosures, as Tom pointed out too, was another one. But it takes time and it takes effort and work in that year to document your conclusions. These are typically tend to, in our example, pretty static items, so they don't bear much updating in the future years. But in that year that you give it a fresh look, it does take time. We make sure we document our conclusions and build processes around them so that we can keep track of them over time. So, in that year certainly wouldn't have been less expensive to do what we did. It would have been less expensive to just roll the document and put everything in. But again, we do it for the purposes of clarity, and certainly there'll be benefits going forward because the less things you have to disclose, obviously there'll be less cost. But just to sort of state that point again, it's certainly not cost beneficial in the year that you give it that fresh look.
And just quickly to go back to a point you made, Tom, I think as a standard setter, we have every incentive to bring preparers and investors together. One, I think you get a better end result. We just talked recently about improving tax disclosure, and there's been a lot of interest currently in the disclosures around tax. And having a forum with preparers, auditors, and most importantly, getting the users at the table as part of that discussion. One, as I said, it improves the package, but selfishly, as a standard setter, it also helps acceptance if the parties are talking to each other, because we're not in the middle saying users told us this, and we can do that, but it's much more effective when other people are hearing that discussion and somebody then pushes back on why didn't the preparer want to provide this, of drilling down, well, what is the real cost? So I think the acceptance between all parties has also helped when you can get people talking directly to each other.
So recently, speaking of FASB and initiatives done by FASB, FASB recently proposed some changes to the materiality definition, the concept statements, and around the same time, the SEC put out some requests for comments on disclosure within the SX, Regulation XX. What are the impacts on disclosure of these two different initiatives?
So I can start with the document that we recently issued, an exposure draft on materiality. We issued really two exposure drafts, one on our concept statements. We have a conceptual framework going back to the very beginning days of the FASB in the early 70s. Concept statement two, so our second concept statement, had a definition of materiality. It was very closely aligned with the Supreme Court definition, loosely something would be material if it would be probable to change effectively the total mix of information to investors. It's loose paraphrase, but very aligned with the Supreme Court definition. In about 2010, we updated our concept statements. We issued concept statement 8, that actually changed some of the language in materiality, and we had a definition that talked about material being something that could impact an investor. And I don't think at the time, in the effort to seek an alignment at the conceptual level, and our conceptual framework is non-authoritative. It's really how the board thinks about materiality and setting standards. So it was never intended to be a tool for preparers, per se, to think about materiality. There's Supreme Court definition. The SEC since then has provided guidance in a staff accounting bulletin. And that really aligns with concept statement two. That became out of line in 2010. And so the proposal on the concept statement is really to move back. It's one, to eliminate the FASB definition and say the Supreme Court definition that was aligned with the old definition is really how the board should be thinking about materiality as it sets standards. Of course, we're not making assessments of errors. We're thinking about what types of information ought to be, as a first starting point, broadly relevant to people. The second piece of that, which was a separate exposure draft, is more operational. That is indicating that, which is a concept that's long been in GAAP. At the end of, if you've historically followed the FASB, at the end of every pronouncement pre-codification was a little box that said the provisions in this standard need not apply to immaterial items. That got brought in as a single statement into the codification, and so this is really clarifying as it relates to disclosure. If you don't apply the standard to an immaterial item, it is not an accounting error. And the third piece of, or a piece of that is as well, to think about how prescriptive we want to be, or do we want to provide for flexibility and scalability. So to take out where we've said in standards like share-based payments, you shall disclose at a minimum, to continue to provide lists of disclosures but not have statements that would limit flexibility, such as at a minimum, which cause people to think about, well, I can't omit any of these, even if they're not material, because that was never the intended effect, but we see that sort of a behavioral effect. And so that's an exposure draft that just recently went out. So obviously this will be around for history, but if you're listening now, please provide your comments.
Yeah, and I mean, I think on the FASB, proposal, obviously there's been, a little bit of controversy over, is this giving corporate America the ability, to not disclose things that they previously would have been required to disclose? And as Jim said, I think it's clarifying, some of the intent around disclosure. Certainly, if a disclosure is material under any reasonable viewpoint, that the disclosure is required. I think there are some other, knock-on impacts, such as, do you need to tell audit committees about disclosures that perhaps might have been in FASB standards but weren't made because a company made a determination that they weren't material? And so I think this helps to clarify that, under the proposal, if it's not material, you don't have to make it. So to the extent that you don't make it, it's not considered to be an omitted disclosure. It's not considered to be any sort of an error in disclosure. So, I do think there's been, some controversy that perhaps this is going to allow companies to not disclose things. I don't think that was the intent. I don't think that will be the outcome. I think it just clarifies what most people believe to be, practice. So I think it's good. I think from the FASB's perspective, it will help in in this clarification, and that's positive. As it relates to the SEC, I mean, I think the SEC is also, they're embarking on a look at disclosure effectiveness broadly. This is the first request for comment that they've come out with on a view that, or on an item that could be viewed as narrow. Do you have to provide financial information on an entity other than the parent company? So if you're acquiring a company, do you need to provide information on the company that you're about to acquire? If you have an equity method investment, do you have to provide financial information about the investee? And so it's really asking for comment about how is this information used? Because again, getting back to the conversation we were just having, are users of the financial statements really using this information? And let's understand how they're using it so that we can make sure that the disclosures that are being provided are relevant and useful. Because many of these disclosures are quite time consuming for preparers to put together and for auditors to audit. So let's make sure that those who are using it are really using it. Are there tweaks that can be made to it or significant changes that can be made to it to make it more useful? If by and large, in some instances, they're not looking at it, then we ought to think about whether we're providing it. Again, I don't think this is a view of trying to take information away from investors. My sense is that if investors report to the SEC that this information is very useful and here's how they use it and here's why they need to continue to get it, that that voice will be heard. And so I would encourage everybody to comment on the proposal from the SEC. But again, I think it's all about trying to just understand how do we make sure that we've got the right information out there for the public and for the users and the consumers of financial data to use in the analysis that they do, and not in an attempt to keep information from investors or users of financial information or just arbitrarily shorten the financial reports.
You know, what's interesting to me about the materiality discussion, in particular what Jim went through about what the FASB has recently discussed, is where we sit today and where I hope we'd sit in the different than where I hope we'd sit in the future is, you know, we use the term materiality a lot. We use it so frequently, and yet I think there's such different views on what that term means, and maybe it's derivatives. So while we can all probably look at the Supreme Court definition of materiality and understand it, when you look at the inverse of that, which is immaterial, it's a little bit like talking about contingencies and whether there's probable at one end and remote on the other. And so you wouldn't just say that there's probable and improbable, because there's lots of layers underneath improbable. It might be more likely than not, possible, remote. And so there's material and then there's immaterial. And I can't say I remember it because it was alive for it. But when Chair Williams spoke to the AICPA in 1981, or just after the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was enacted, and there was a little bit of, to me, the same kind of concern, because now there's this books and records requirement. And if you look at it, you could say, gosh, what do I have to pay attention? Do I have to pay attention to every penny, literally every penny that I spend as a company? And that would be, you know, so costly, it's just inoperable. And in that speech, he described that there's essentially three levels. There's a de minimis, and then there's a reasonable sort of level where you keep your books and records. And he explains in that speech that it certainly wasn't meant to be at the material level, because if you kept your books and records for payments to foreign officials at the material level, there'd be so much that wouldn't be kept and that wouldn't be effective. But it also wasn't meant to be at the de minimis level that you're, you know, sort of sitting around worried about pennies, if you will. And to me, that's a little bit of the disclosure discussion that in practice, I think we all know that we're not talking about the close calls. So if something might be material, that gets in the document. Everyone errs on the side of conservatism. We are literally talking about things that are so obvious that you're embarrassed to bring them to the audit committee. That, you know, these are items, and you can say it stems from having a single view of materiality as if it could be reduced to a number, which no matter how many times we talk about it, it cannot be. But if you did reduce it to an individual number, the income statement and the balance sheet are two fundamentally different statements. The balance sheet is large, and it's your big brother, and the income statement's small. And so if you base it off the income statement and reduce it to a numerical threshold, then you could be bringing things to an audit committee on a balance sheet that's billions and billions of dollars and are clearly de minimis. And so as the sort of I applaud the FASB for taking the step that they did, and, you know, it starts the conversation, which can always be a touchy conversation, but I think a good one and an important one, because I wouldn't want people to get the feeling that all of a sudden there are all these close calls that will not be disclosed. That's not at all what it is like in practice. It is these things that are clearly immaterial, where institutional investor, retail investor, regulator, auditor, preparer, standard setter all looks at that and says, really, is that sincerely what we're talking about? And so it's much easier than it sounds from this sort of high-level discussion.
I think, Dan, it's a perfect point. This was not intended to take important information, that the close call, and take that away. There's safeguards in the system that exist and will continue to exist. And it's a little bit like the bad story that gets told 100 times and the great story gets told to, you know, two or three people. And you hear stories of the corporate boardroom of having to go to the audit committee with things that just don't matter, and it gets replicated into people are spending time on the unimportant. And they could be reallocating that time to the important. And that I don't want people, as a standard setter, spending time on unimportant things, or let's move on and go to the important. And that's really the objective here. One of the safeguards, if you were to be concerned that this was about the borderline significant, and the auditor has an obligation to take close calls to the audit committee in any respect, meaning sort of the significant judgment. So if you had a close call, and the auditor would have to, if you had a company that says, I don't want to do this close call in that rare circumstance, the auditor's already got a governance response to involve folks. So.
And well, that's said in the spirit of the FASB, or it's said in the spirit of both, although I was talking about the FASB. If you look at the SEC's invitation to comment about financial information for people other than the registrant, one of the rules in there is Rule 310 that provides relief to companies that that you know might have an issuer of debt that's a subsidiary, but if it's 100% owned, if it meets certain conditions, then you can avail yourself of this rule and not have to provide standalone financial statements of this 100% owned entity that you've issued a guarantee to, and you can instead put that information in a condensed consolidating format in a footnote, which you know, I think is a very good rule with respect to trying to provide some common sense and some cost of compliance relief with respect to that particular topic. So as they look at that rule, I think it's a good one. I wish more people could get into it because the 100% owned is a particularly high test and a bright line, and one in particular that we think. As a result of the way that we have organized our subsidiaries, we ought to be able to avail ourselves of. But that, to me, is another example of one that's not even a close call. Although the test would not allow us to avail ourselves of that particular rule, when you look at it and we can explain it, you say, this isn't even a close one. You're indifferent to the financial statements of that subsidiary. And so while, you know, albeit probably too technical for this discussion, it's not the close calls. It's the ones that everybody can look around a table and say, yeah, we clearly don't need those disclosures.
Well, we're coming to the end of our discussion. So if we were to look at this, at disclosure effectiveness a year from now, where might we, what might we be discussing then?
I mean, you know, look, I think if we look out a year from now, we can say that we've been successful if we've advanced the dialogue. And I think, as Jim mentioned, if we bring more people to the table, if we get users, preparers, auditors, standard setters, and regulators to really have a fulsome conversation around what really is relevant, what really is important, what really is needed. We're not, again, I've said it repeatedly, we're not focused on how to bring down the number of pages. We're focused on how to make sure that what's there is high quality, recognizing the time constraints that exist in getting a set of financial statements out and the deadlines for getting them filed. So my hope is that over the next year we can start that. I think the SEC and the FASB have both put forth some modest proposals that should allow us to start that dialogue in good faith together to move forward with the goal of continuing to have the highest quality financial reporting and accounting in the world. And let's go execute disclosure effectiveness with that as a backdrop.
So I would agree with that. And if you look at not just the proposals we've talked about, but we have finalized a significant increase to disclosures around insurance companies. So short duration insurance is an area where investors said, you know, we really would like a greater understanding of historical loss patterns. We've got that done. We have proposals that we're close to on income tax disclosures, on fair value disclosures, an area where people have called for a look at whether or not the volume serves everyone, not necessarily, you know, the largest financial institution. So we've got those out, and I hope we make real progress there. And I think thinking about materiality is going to be critical to the success of being more prescriptive in some areas to get to that material, but providing that flexibility. So I hope we've moved that in a year.
And I'll be a bit of a wet blanket. It took decades to get here. It'll take a long time to get out of where we are. If we're still talking about disclosure effectiveness in a year, I think that's success.
Great. Well, I guess we are coming to the end of this discussion now. I should note that, first of all, I would like to thank Jim, Dan, and Tom for their insights. Thank you so much for sharing them. I should note that their views are their own views and not of their organizations, their current organizations, or their past organizations. I hope that as an audience that you have found this to be an informative discussion on disclosure effectiveness. This program will also add to a valuable body of knowledge in the program series. The audio of the broadcast will be available soon in the Virtual Museum and Archive, and edited transcript will be available later. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank Deloitte LLP again for their generosity and assistance in making today's program possible. Thank you for joining us today. Remember, you can go to www.sechistorical.org to find other documents and the previous fireside chats. Thank you for joining us today, and have a good afternoon.